Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
Look, Megan, it's a family. There's Daddy, and this one is you, and this one is me. She pointed to the female figure. Is this you, Deidre? She asked, her eyes pleading for the answer she wanted. Deidre wasn't quite sure how to respond. Would you like that to be me? She asked. The girls nodded. Okay, then that's me. Her answer satisfied them, and nothing more was said. As they were cleaning up the paper mess, Ben leaned close to her. I'm not putting them up to this, I swear. That's all right. They're just children. By the way, thank you for the beautiful sweater. I've always wanted one, but never afforded myself the luxury, she said, changing the subject. But for the glow of candles set in every window and a collection arranged on the altar, the church was darkened when they arrived. Deidre was not comfortable in that setting, but as she sat, taking in the shadows and light patterns produced by the open flames, she began to relax. She was seated next to Ben, and he reached over and took her hand. Megan was on the other side of her and intertwined her arm inside Deidre's elbow. Deidre held a copy of the Order of Service in her free hand, and she noticed that even though much was strange, she recognized the titles of the hymns. O little town of Bethlehem, it came upon a midnight clear, and hark the herald angels sing. The one tune she didn't recognize was Silent Night Benediction. She didn't recognize the name of the composer, but an asterisk after his name led her to a brief note that he was a local composer. Before she could read more, the service began, the congregation stood, and the house lights were brought up so they could read the words to the carol. By the time they finished the song, the processional had reached the front of the church, and the pastor began to speak. Immediately, Deidre's mind began to wander, and she found herself lost in thought, wondering what the child victims were doing in the hospital, wondering if the abductors would be so brazen as to attempt one more delivery of human lives that was scheduled after Christmas, wondering how many more lives would be destroyed by the river of young women flowing from Thunder Bay to Duluth. Her thoughts were disrupted when a box of small candles was passed down her row. She watched as everyone took one and adjusted a wax guard to protect their fingers. Megan showed her how to do it, and she sat waiting for further directions. The pastor instructed everyone, "Please tilt your unlit candle toward the lit candle of your neighbor. That way melted wax will not drip on the floor." The house lights were extinguished, and the ushers lit the candles of those congregants sitting on the aisle. The next person from the aisle lit his or her candle off the lit one, and so on down the row. In seconds, the wave reached Deidre, and she successfully passed on the light. Soon the sanctuary was lit by the glow of hundreds of candles. From the front of a church, someone began to softly play the piano, and a tenor voice sang softly, "Peace I give to you, not as the world knows peace. Peace I give to you, God grant us peace." As the singer's mellow voice led the congregation through the words, almost like a chant, Deidre felt herself being caught up in the moment. When will the world ever know peace, she thought. Will there ever be peace? A tear ran down her cheek and dripped off her chin, and she found herself singing the words, her eyes closed, and desperately, she wanted to claim the peace she was feeling at that moment. Without notice, the song leader smoothly slipped into singing Silent Night. After the last verse was sung, everyone extinguished their candles, and the sanctuary went dark, except for the candles on the altar and those in the windows. Even though hundreds of people filled the sanctuary, there was not a sound. Not the rustle of papers, not the sound of someone rushing to put on their jackets so they could make a quick getaway, not even a cough. Row by row, the ushers directed the exit of the worshipers. Still, no one talked, and even in the narthex, people were speaking in hushed tones. On the way home, they were silent. Megan and Maren were half asleep in the back seat, and Ben and Deidre were buried deep in their own thoughts. Why can't our lives be filled with this kind of peace every day, she wondered. Certainly humanity has made enough progress that we can cease injuring each other. Ben pulled into the driveway. Together they carried the sleeping children into the house and to their rooms. Deidre couldn't get past their childhood innocence as, in their sleep, They curled up and buried their heads in their pillows. She kissed each of them before leaving their room. As they quietly made their way downstairs, Ben whispered, "Time for Santa to arrive." He went to the basement, and Deirdre could hear him rummaging around. In a few minutes, he came up the stairs, laden with packages. Santa had a good year, he laughed. For the next half hour, they arranged the gifts. The girls had left out carrots for the reindeer and cookies for Santa. The carrots went back in the refrigerator, and Ben ate the cookies, making sure to leave some crumbs on the plate. 6:30 the next morning, Deirdre awoke to squeals of delight coming from downstairs, followed by racing footsteps coming upstairs. "Deirdre," Marin exclaimed, her eyes wide open, "you got to see this. Hurry! Santa came last night." They grabbed Deirdre's hands and pulled her out of bed. Ben was already in the kitchen. He emerged with a cup of coffee in each hand. "Daddy, can we start now?" "Go for it," he said, handed Deirdre her cup, and sat down to watch the excitement. Amid exclamations of, "Look what he brought for me, and it's just what I wanted," Deirdre could do nothing but grin. She looked at Ben, and he winked at her. About mid-morning, Ben's mother and father arrived. Rebecca gave Deirdre the once-over. "Looks like you've been spending a lot of time here lately," she said abruptly. "Rebecca," Jim butted in, "we're delighted to see you again, Deirdre. You must forgive Rebecca. She fell off the wrong side of the bed this morning." Rebecca gave him a sideways glance and stomped off to the kitchen, where Deirdre heard her asking Ben if he needed her help. Jim took Deirdre's hands. "It's okay. She just needs some time to get used to things being different. She and Jenny were like mother and daughter, and I think Rebecca's still mourning her death. Be patient." And he gave Deirdre a hug. At that moment, Deirdre decided her only recourse was to show Rebecca, then to tell her how easily she was fitting into her granddaughter's lives. By the time Christmas Day was history, she thought she had made some progress. When Jim and Rebecca were heading out the door, Jim hugged her and whispered in her ear, "Hang with us. Everything's going to be fine." That evening, after the kids had been put to bed, the two adults sat staring at the tree, exhausted. "Do you have a lot to do tomorrow and Friday?" Deirdre looked at Ben and realized she had very little on her agenda until the next week when the Aegean Sea would be coming into port. "Not really. What do you have in mind?" Ben had an expectant smile on his face. "I've got just a few things to clear up at the office. I could be done about 10 on Friday. What if you got your cabin warmed up? The three of us could be there by late afternoon. I know the girls would love being in the woods in the winter. What do you think? I'll bring the food if you want, and we could stay till late Sunday." Deirdre was thrilled. She wondered why she hadn't thought of the idea herself. As they sat staring at the tree again, she pictured what it would be like to be snowed in with them at the cabin. Chapter 27. Deirdre washed down the last bite of toast with what coffee remained in her cup. "Well, I'd better get going. Last night I decided I would stop and see how the three girls in the hospital are recovering. See you tomorrow. I'll have a friend plow the road into the cabin, and the fire will be going." "Whoa, just a minute," Ben said, and he stood up from his place at the table. "You're not getting out of here without a proper send-off." He gave her a very tight hug and kissed her forehead. "I'm getting to dislike the wait between our times together," he groused. Deirdre smiled as she buried her head on his chest. She reached up and gave him a quick kiss. "See you tomorrow." It was a shift change when Deirdre stopped at the nurse's station and doctors were reviewing patients' charts, preparing to do rounds. Deirdre spotted Dr. Bilka, the pediatrician attending the girls. She looked up from the chart she was studying. "Deirdre, you're saving me a phone call. I have marvelous news for you. Kimmy has responded so positively to Allison's presence that she's begun to come out of her shell. She has a long way to go, but she's conversing and initiating dialogue. Her appetite has even picked up. The other girl, she says her name is Jean, is out of ICU and has joined the two for daily visits. They don't laugh much, but they share their feelings with each other, and that is so positive. I wanted to invite you to meet with them. Each is so thankful for what you did for them. If you have time, they should have been served breakfast and you could get together right now." "I was hoping I could, but tell me, what happens to them now?" "We've been in contact with the chief of police of the Anishinaabe Aski Nation. He's arranging all of the legal papers that will be needed to bring them home. He's assured us that their social service organization will provide psychiatric assistance." Dr. Bilka turned to a nurse. "Will you please tell Allison, she's in room 420, and Jean in room 431, that Deirdre is here and would like to see them in Kimmy Thomas's room? Thank you." Deirdre walked down the hall to Kimmy's room, dodging workers pushing food carts, lab techs with their baskets of needles, and everyone else who made the hospital a place of restoration. She knocked on Kimmy's door before entering. Kimmy was sitting on the edge of her bed, finishing a glass of orange juice while she watched a morning TV show. When she saw Deidre, her eyes lit up in a way Deidre had never seen before. Deidre! But before she could say more, the two other victims entered the room. Allison touched Deidre's arm. Hi, was all she said. A third girl entered. You must be Jean. I'm Deidre Johnson, she introduced herself. And for several minutes, they talked about how the hospital food was, if they were comfortable, and other mundane bits of conversation. Finally, Deidre thought she could broach the subject she wanted to discuss. I have an awfully big favor to ask of you girls. Maybe it's asking too much, and if it is, I want you to tell me without hesitation. Quizzically, the girls looked at her. Can we talk about the place where you were held captive? Will you try to remember what the place looked like? If it's too painful, please tell me, and we can just visit for a while. The room was silent, then Allison spoke first. I remember the cabin had one room. Jean broke in. There were 8 beds, 4 along each wall. They were made of boards, and the mattresses were old and smelly, Allison added. Kimmy looked out the window, a faraway look in her eyes. We were chained by one ankle to the foot of the bed. The chain was long enough for us to reach one of the pails they set in between the rows of beds. That was our toilet. Deidre shuddered at the image. There were 2 small windows on each side wall, and 1 in front, Allison said. And the door was heavy, like it was made of really thick boards, Jean added. It was locked from the outside with a large brass padlock, Kimmy volunteered. The girls were beginning to feed off each other's memories. Deidre thought for a moment and then asked Kimmy, Are you sure about the lock? Kimmy nodded. Anna and I escaped through the front window. It was hinged and I was able to push out the bottom and crawl through the opening. I fell on the deck of a small porch and the door was right beside me. I saw the lock. Tears began to form in her eyes and dribble down her face. We ran up a trail, but then we heard someone swearing and breaking through the brush. One of the men came after us. I ran one way, Anna another. He went after Anna and caught her. I made my way to the road. It was a long way through the woods, and caught a ride with some logger going to Silver Bay. I had him drop me off at the main highway, thinking I could find my way back home. I ended up in that deserted cabin where you found me. Kimmy went silent, and neither of the other 2 girls had any more to say. Together, the 4 of them sat with bowed heads, and the winter sun shined through the hospital window. I hear you will all be going back to Canada very soon. Will you please keep in touch with me? I truly want to know how you are doing. She handed them her name card. My email address is on this. Contact me anytime. Perhaps when this is all over, we can get together for a picnic or a nice meal at a restaurant. The girls took turns saying goodbye and offered their thanks one more time. It was especially difficult for Kimmy to let go, and after a prolonged tug, Deidre whispered in her ear, You're safe now. It will be okay. 2 people were in the elevator when the door opened, and they looked at her face, then looked away in embarrassment. They didn't want to stare at the lady dabbing her eyes and blowing her nose on the trip down to the parking garage. Before pulling out into traffic, she called the person who plowed the driveway into her cabin. Hey, Jerry, she said when he answered. I'm coming up to my cabin this weekend, and I need the driveway plowed out. It will probably take a while to clear the half-mile stretch, but we haven't had too much snow yet. How much do you think? 1 foot? Oh, that much, she answered, after Jerry updated her estimate. Anyway, do you think you could have it opened up by this evening? Thanks a million, Jerry, she said to his reply. Chapter 28. On the way north, Deidre mulled over her role in what was left of the investigation. She had been in daily contact with the BCA for more than a month, and they agreed with her that because the FBI had pretty much assumed the lead, she should back out. She planned to close her office the next week and file her final report with the state agency. In a way, it felt good to think of being free of the responsibility, but on the other hand, it felt like she was dropping out of a foot race. She wondered what would happen to Gerald Coulter, both father and son. And what about Judge DeMarcus? Would he be implicated, or at least be barred from the courtroom? Of course, there were the 3 girls. Would they grow up in spite of their emotional scars? These thoughts and many more concerning the case crowded her mind, and she was almost to 2 harbors before it dawned on her how far she had traveled. It was noon when she stopped at Inga's and picked up her dog. Inga wasn't home, so she left a note on the door saying hi and that she had taken Pete with her. The thought occurred to her that she was only an hour from her cabin, and Jerry said he wouldn't have the driveway cleared until 5 or so. She decided to stop and see her old friend Pete, the logger after whom she had jokingly named her black lab. He was outside splitting wood for his stove when Deidre pulled up alongside his rusted-out pickup. Pete straightened his back and shielded his eyes against the afternoon sun. His face broke into a grin, and he put down his splitting axe. "Well, Deidre Johnson, how the heck are you? And you brought Pete with you. You know I still haven't forgiven you for naming him that," he chuckled, and the gaps formed by a few missing teeth showed. A year-old lab came running out from the woods, and she circled the pair, her tail wagging and begging for attention. "Pete, you got another lab," Deidre exclaimed. "Yeah, after the old guy died, I thought I wouldn't get another. At first I thought it would be foolish, because I'm so old. But then I thought, heck, I might outlive another one. So I picked up this girl at the animal shelter in Two Harbors. Somebody dropped her off because she had too much energy for them. I was lucky. She's a great dog." "What did you name her?"
"Deidre."
"What?" Deidre asked in astonishment. "Fair is fair," was all Pete had to say. Then he added, "I call her Deed for short, though." And Deidre could see his shoulders shaking from suppressed laughter. "Come on in, bring Pete with you. He can meet Deed, and we can have a piece of pie and a cup of coffee." As they sat at Pete's two-person table, he asked, "What have you been up to? Haven't seen you for a good 3 months. I thought maybe you had gone south for the winter. Thought you might be wimping out on us." He slurped his coffee, but he couldn't stifle the mirth in his eyes. "Do you remember hearing about the girl that was found dead under the Silver Bay Bridge?"
"You know, I don't get out much, but Terry told me that he thought you were involved in it somehow. How'd it turn out?"
"Can't tell you too much until everything is done, but it hasn't been a good scene. Somewhere up here, girls are being held and then sold into prostitution, a few at a time, mostly the sailors on the ship stocked in the harbor in Duluth." Pete took another swig of coffee, got up, and spit out the door.
"Those jerks.
I've lived in the woods my whole life, seen a lot of things up here. I've watched a pack of wolves pull down a moose, seen a bear walk off with a newborn fawn, even seen a red squirrel climb my feeder and snatch a pine siskin right off the platform. That unnerved me, I'll tell you. Squirrels aren't supposed to do that. But you know, Deidre, I've never seen animals do what humans are capable of doing to each other. I know it's not right, but sometimes I'm happy to be so isolated that I can let all this crap pass me by. I get so angry when I hear of what's happening out there," and he swept his arm toward the south and east. "I don't want to know about it." He gulped his coffee. Deidre patted Pete's hand. "I feel that way too. But then I think, if each of us can do one thing in our lives to make a change, then the world is a little better place. Remember how willing you were to help me when I needed your assistance tracking down that gang of meth manufacturers? You're a good man, Pete. Don't underestimate your ability to make a difference. I know how you look out for the logger's widow down the road. You let it slip once. And what about the way you took care of Jarvin in the time he broke his foot getting off his skidder? You drove it for a month while he healed. If I remember, you didn't collect any pay, but you had the logging company send him the check. Pete, you old goat, you can't fool me. You do what you can to help others." Pete took a bite of his pie so he wouldn't have to answer. The two visited for a long time, and Pete looked out his window. "Only about 2 hours of daylight left. You better get going if you're going to make it to your cabin with some daylight to spare." Deidre looked at her watch. "No, it's not even 3 yet. Jerry said he wouldn't be done with the plowing by at least 5. Pete's eyes lit up. "Well, then you're staying for supper." Deidre laughed. "Thought you'd never ask." He sat down and made himself comfortable. A thought struck Deidre. "Say, Pete, you wouldn't know any businesses around here that might have the initials or logo RRR? I found an old brass key that had those letters stamped on it. Looked to be from an old lock."
"Geez, I haven't thought of that place for years. Where'd you find the key? In that antique place in Beaver Bay?"
"No, nothing like that. I just found it, and I've been wondering where it came from. It seems to be rather unique.
You know about it, then?"
Pete shrugged. "I might. Suppose there are a lot of keys that were made like that, but I know of one place that used big, heavy brass locks, the Rocky River Resort." Deidre's heart skipped a beat, and she asked, a little too excitedly, "What can you tell me about it?" Pete looked at the log beams overhead in his cabin.
Well, let's see. It must have been 1938. No, 1939. At least that's what my folks used to say. This area was pretty wild back then, you know. Dieter wanted to scream, "For God's sake, get on with it, Pete." But she held her tongue. She knew he would eventually get to the point. I've heard that a group of businessmen from Minneapolis bought two sections of land. It went cheap back then. The area had been logged off by the timber barons 20 years before, and it had come back with scrub timber, balsam and poplar, sometimes birch. You could buy land for 50 cents an acre. Of course, nobody around here could scrape up enough money to grab it. Well, anyway, these guys from Minneapolis bought two sections, pushed a road in about a mile to the Rocky River. Then they built a hunting lodge. I've seen it, been in it. They made it out of timber they got from a small area the loggers had missed in 1910, or whenever they cut that area. Huge pines. Dieter had to stifle her desire to begin asking questions. She put another bite of pie in her mouth and sipped coffee. Pete continued rambling. Yep, that was quite a lodge. They hunted up here with a gang of their friends for a couple of years, and then the war broke out. My dad and most of the men who lived up here enlisted, so they were gone for a few years. I had a chance to roam the woods, and a couple of times my older brother took me with when he walked the road they had put in. Best grouse hunting you ever seen. I guess that's not what you're interested in, though. The couple of times I got back there, you could tell it wasn't being used. One window had been shot out, and somebody had broken in and taken most of the stuff from the lodge. After the war, you'd have thought they'd have come back and fixed it up, but a year later they sold it to some guy from Chicago. Believe it or not, he came up here to live. Fixed the lodge up and built a dozen cabins. Advertised he was opening a fishing resort. Used to be 2-pound brook trout in that river. He did okay. A lot of people from Chicago came here and paid big money to experience what I had all my life. By then I was old enough to go to work, and I did odd jobs around the resort for him. Even got to do a little guiding. He had a boy about 10 years older than me, who he really loved, and they did everything together. Then in 1951, his son was drafted and was sent to Korea, got killed there. The guy was never the same after that. He asked me to go fishing with him one day, but he didn't fish much at all, just watched me. On the way back to the lodge, he told me he was going back to Chicago. The place sat empty ever since. I got back there a few times. Everything was starting to fall apart. Last time I saw it, it must have been 10 years ago. 3 or 4 years ago, somebody posted the land, strung no trespassing signs all around its perimeter. We thought maybe somebody was going to try to make something of the place, but I guess not. Dieter was sitting on the edge of her chair. Do you know who bought it? No, some people tried to find out, but the records at the courthouse show that it belongs to a trust, whatever that is. There's no way to track down the owners. Tell me, Pete, was there anything unusual about the locks on the doors? How do you know that? They were really heavy, made of brass, I think, and big. They made me think of the kind of lock you might find on a seaman's trunk, the kind that needed a big key to open it. Funny thing, though, they were placed on the outside of the cabin. There was another hasp inside, so the guests could lock the door from either inside or outside. I still don't know why you want to know all of this. It's ancient history. Pete, will you tell me where this place is? Sure, it's no secret. Go back a mile on Highway 1 and take a right on the Bagna Lake Road. Go another 2 miles, and on the left you'll see what used to be 2 stone and concrete pillars that mark the driveway entrance. It's mostly grown up now, but I think you can still make it out. Before he could say any more or ask any questions, Deidre stood up and began to put on her jacket. You make supper. I'm going to take a drive. I'll be back by 5 or so. And she started out the door. Don't get caught back there after dark, Pete warned. Everything looks different once the sun sets, and I don't want to have to come looking for you. It's supposed to be below 0 tonight. Do you have a flashlight? And make sure you take some matches with you. How about a compass? Do you have one? Deidre turned to face her friend. She was almost as tall as he was, he being stooped from many years of working in the woods. Got them all, and don't worry, I just want to look around the place. Be back soon. She gave his sinewy arm a squeeze before she left. Pete shook his head after he closed the door. Got a mind of her own, that one, he muttered to himself, and went to his stove to check the pot of stew simmering on the front burner. Using a large serving spoon, he scooped up a piece of venison that was cooking in the broth and sampled it, added a pinch more of salt, and turned the burner off. Pete heard Deidre back up and drive away. He looked out the window, wishing she hadn't gone off on her own. Chapter 29. Deidre drove into the setting sun and had to shield her eyes from the glare off the pure snow. The clock on her dash showed it was 3:05. In an hour and a half, it would be dark. She remembered that the moon was in its full phase, and she was comforted by the thought that she could make it back to her SUV in the moonlight. Traveling on Highway 1 was easy because the county workers had plowed it and spread a mixture of sand and salt to melt the ice. However, it was a different story when she turned onto Bagna Lake Road. As she made the turn, she felt the rear end of her vehicle begin to yaw and it swing first one way, then the other. She spun the steering wheel in the opposite direction of the skids, and after two or three oscillations, her vehicle straightened out and she continued on her way, but at a slower pace. As Pete had predicted, 2 miles down the road, she came to large fieldstone columns by the side of the road. In places, a rock or two had been dislodged by frost and time, but for the most part, they were intact. Deidre pulled as far off the road as she could without becoming stuck in the snowbanks piled up by a county plow. She stepped onto the frozen road, and a gust of Arctic air hit her in the face. It was going to get very cold as soon as the sun set, she thought. She removed her pistol from its holster, checked the magazine, checked to make sure a round was chambered, and then set the safe. She returned the pistol to her belt and zipped her jacket before pulling up its hood, and last, she pulled on heavy winter mittens to protect her hands from frostbite. As she approached the two cairns that used to guard the entrance to the resort, she noticed a no trespassing sign with an ominous message, "Violators will be prosecuted," attached to each. Most surprising to her were snowmobile tracks leading up the trail from the road. They were covered by dusting of snow, indicating the trail hadn't been traveled since last week. The footing underneath was packed and frozen solid, so walking was not difficult. Any other day, she would have enjoyed the hike. A snowshoe hare had crossed the path, leaving behind a distinctive trail of elongated footprints. The tracks told a story of struggle and death, but also survival. It ended in a patch of blood-stained snow bordered by the imprints of large wings, and Deidre knew that a great horned owl had descended on its prey in the middle of the night. The rabbit died, the owl lived. As she observed the evidence of the battle for existence, Deidre carried no ill feeling toward the owl. It did what it had to do to survive the harsh Minnesota winter. On the other hand, she wanted nothing more than to find and punish those people preying on young women, people who weren't doing it to survive, but to fulfill their evil need to dominate and to satisfy their own greed. She trudged on through the snow for another 20 minutes until she reached a spot in the trail where it curved to the right while going up a steep hill.
You've been listening to episode 15 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors, here on Literally from the North Shore.